Is there still hope for manufacturing jobs in central Illinois? Local business leaders think so, but it depends on whether the skills being taught in schools match up with what employers want. Here's McLean County Chamber of Commerce President Charlie Moore.
There is a lot of work that has been done, a lot of work yet to do, but the real focus that I think employers as a whole are asking for help on is really the essential employability skills.
And the Miller Park Zoo in Bloomington is one of the oldest in the country.
So that's Rojo, our tiger. He just got fed.
We also hear about its nationally known snow leopard conservation program, plus how modern 4-H programs are embracing science and technology. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the news update. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This week, we've been focusing on the Bloomington Normal region. Like many parts of Illinois, it's an area that used to have a significant manufacturing presence. That changed in 2015 when Mitsubishi decided to close up shop and end its U.S. operations. So there was a lot of excitement in town when a little-known company called Rivian bought the former plant. That company is an electric vehicle startup based mainly in Michigan. There's still a lot to learn about Rivian. We invited them on the program and they did not respond to our request. But local business leaders are excited about having them come to town, and so are city leaders. Rivian's now on track to receive $49.5 million in tax credits over the next 10 years in order to help create 1,000 jobs. They also want to partner with local schools to help train the next generation of skilled manufacturing workers. Charlie Moore is president and CEO of the McLean County Chamber of Commerce. I sat down with him at our partner station WGLT earlier this week, shortly after he visited Rivian's headquarters in Michigan. I started by asking him what he took away from his visit.
So they have a fantastic story to tell. They were coming to look at the plant initially as an opportunity to purchase some of the assets within the plant, not to purchase a plant in and of itself. And what they found was when they came to town and they were actually in Uptown sitting in a coffee shop and just listening to the conversations that were happening around them. And they at that point said, you know, this is where I think we need to be. We need to look at more than just assets. What's this going to look like for our company in the long term? As crazy as that may sound, one of the biggest selling points as to why they really considered purchasing the plant and moving forward with the manufacturing of the Rivian automobiles here. And so I can tell you that Rivian has come in as a strong partner, because they are off on the side of town and because our numbers are around the 40 point, as you talked about right now, there's not a lot of talk about them because there's not a product yet to look at, right? And so it makes it sometimes
difficult.
They're not
producing electric vehicles just yet.
That's exactly right. But, you know, they have said that, you know, they'll be ramping up. So we're talking about workforce with them right now. They're talking about ramping up in 2019 and production starting in 2020. And that'll be here within the blink of an eye when you take a look at all the moving parts, no pun intended, that come with automobile manufacturing. And so I can tell you that when you leave a conversation with the folks at Rivian, you leave mind-boggled because the things that they're talking about, just the technology, the innovation, the creativity, what they're looking at and how that will directly impact our local economy, how that will directly impact the automobile industry. I mean, it's definitely some disruptive technology going on as to how we think about the way transportation works today. And so we did have the opportunity to answer your question to go up and visit them yesterday in Detroit, or in Plymouth, if you will, at their plant. It's very, very interesting, intriguing, fascinating. I don't know that I have the right adjective when we walked out of there to know so much about what their next steps look like. And so I can tell you that they have an amazing group of very talented people who are working tirelessly every day to make sure that the product that they produce is just going to be one that will turn your head. And I really look forward to over the next 2 years as they continue to talk about their workforce ramping up, getting the prototype done, ready, and then starting the manufacturing process in 2020 will definitely be something for us to celebrate here in McLean County.
And I know that Rivian's on track to receive, I think it's $49.5 million in state tax credits for the creation of 1,000 jobs over the next 10 years. And if those 1,000 jobs do materialize, that would make Rivian one of the top 10 largest employers in McLean County. I wanted to just ask you about the workforce development part of this.
Sure.
We hear so much about advanced manufacturing and how this is the future, in particular in the Midwest. What I also hear from manufacturers often, though, is that there's a skills gap between maybe existing manufacturing workers or laid off manufacturing workers and the kind of skills and technology that are needed for this next generation of advanced manufacturing. Are these, I imagine these electric vehicle production jobs would fall into the category of advanced manufacturing.
For sure.
And what kind of work are you, what are you hearing from not just Rivian, but other manufacturing employers about the skills base if there are workers that exist right now in McLean County to fulfill their needs?
Sure. So how much time do we have? there's a lot of dialogue that's taking place about that right now. And I think that to your point, you know, really understanding what upskilling needs to be done for former Mitsubishi employees who are still in the community or come from around McLean County who worked at the plant for 25 to 28 years prior to its closing. But then what are we doing to make sure that we're intentionally building a pipeline of new talent? So there's a lot of intentional conversation taking place of how do we start working with Rivian, but other companies as well to take
and
a look
community
at.
Community colleges, I imagine Heartland
will
play a big role in this.
So we're going to get there, absolutely, on how are we building curriculum or pathways that really look at starting in seventh grade through high school. You know, what does that opportunity look like to establish relationships with the employers, to understand what their needs are, to make sure that there's curriculum that's being developed so that when they do graduate, if they're choosing not to go into post-secondary, that those opportunities are available and they know exactly what those look like. That we have hands-on experiences, that there's job shadowing, experiential opportunities for kids that are coming up and trying to determine what their career track is going to look like. But also for those who want to go on for their associate's degree in Heartland with the customized training programs that they offer specifically for individual companies or as a whole with curriculum. And as we start to take a look at additional manufacturing with not only Rivian, but now Brandt, who's invested into McLean County, you know, how are we really assessing what their needs are to make sure that we're providing the workforce that they need in the talent pipeline so that as the folks who might be coming back to work that are former Mitsubishi employees come back, but for a very short while, but there's a knowledge transfer that could take place from them on to the next generation of workers, if you will, but then also those that we're bringing up from high school going right into the workforce or those that are transitional from other employment opportunities that they're looking for that next manufacturing opportunity for them, that they have the upskilling opportunity to make sure that they have what it takes to be successful, not only for themselves and their careers, but for the company that's here. So there's a lot of very intentional discussion right now about how we make sure we're looking at who our current talent workforce is, what the future pipeline is going to look like, and how are we intentional about the knowledge transfer between both.
And to the point of the future pipeline, I think a lot of this for this current generation or this upcoming generation of workers is a message that manufacturing is what advanced manufacturing looks like, and is that a viable career path? How are you working on that?
Yeah, so manufacturing today is nothing like it was 10 years ago or 30 years ago or 50 years ago. You know, I laugh. One of the companies I was talking to, neither one of which we've mentioned, is talking about the need for skilled welding, but it's all done via robotics. And so you have to understand how to run the robot. And so it's not just a matter of coming in and putting on. I grew up on a farm, and I'd put on, you know, my welding helmet and get a torch, you know, and I can go and just kind of put pieces together. And that's all it was. And I don't want to minimize that by any stretch. But right now, what employers are looking for and how advanced and how technologically advanced it is, it's not just a, I would call it, you know, for lack of a better word right now, a blue collar job. It really is a career track with high wage earning opportunity and capability. And so we've really got to take a look at, you know, what's that paradigm shift of thinking that I have to go to college, because there's certainly a lot to say about, you know, what college affords someone the opportunity. But on the other hand, if you're not college bound, what are those opportunities for you? And so we partake with an organization in the state called 60 by 25. And it's a 60 by 25 network, which really stands for 60% of your population to have a post-secondary certificate or training by the year 2025. So McLean County is already in the high 50%, right? So we're already doing pretty good on that. However, how do we intentionally keep that number high, and do we get to that 60%? And I'm not saying a post-secondary degree. I'm just saying after you get out of high school, what's the following education or skill sets that you're looking to continue to achieve? So are there licensing? Are there certificates? Are there badging for the backpacks, you know, stackable credentials? What's that look like for people who are trying to advance their careers and their opportunities? And so for sure, in manufacturing in specific, it is definitely a mindset that, you know, there's real work to be done, still using your mind, still still using your hands. That's really important work that needs to be done. And it's more than just what you might think of manufacturing from 50 years ago, in that it's lucrative opportunities and they're jobs that are necessary for not only McLean County, but for jobs throughout the world. People are starting to understand that a little bit more. The other thing that we have to look at in McLean County in specific is that the out-migration that we have of students is real. The out-migration of population in Illinois is real, too.
Right. That's a big problem with not just college students leaving the state, but young people in general.
But if you look at this last week, the Chicago Tribune had an article in there about the number of Illinois students going to the University of Alabama. That's huge. That's one college in Alabama, and I can't recall what the percentage is off the top of my head, but it was surprisingly high of the number of Illinois residents. And so what we're finding in McLean County in specific, we have about a 91% graduation rate between two of our large districts, District 87 and Unit 5. Of that, there's about 80% that indicate post-secondary education, but they're not going here. And right now we're finding surrounding state schools who are offering competitive scholarships and really going after those with the high test scores. And our top talent that's grown here in our own backyard is leaving to go to college outside of not only McLean County, but the state of Illinois. And so we have to do a couple things. We have to make sure, number one, we're starting relationships with students in grade school, through high school, through college. So if they do go to the college, they've had relationship opportunities and experiential opportunities to get them to come back. But moreover, if they're not going to college, that we are intentionally looking at how do we have these job opportunities and how have we well trained and educated those who are going right into the workforce, and we're providing those opportunities right here in our own backyard.
And do you feel comfortable that our K through 12 system is providing a satisfactory math and science background for these young people to prepare them for these careers?
So that's a really good question. Right now, so the work that we're doing when we talk about the BN Advantage, there's a very specific arm of that that's workforce development, and the Chamber has accepted the responsibility to kind of challenge that effort or lead that effort. Obviously, STEM is a great buzzword right now, right? And so I can tell you that in McLean County for the last couple of years, there has been a defined curriculum that has been brought in and purchased for almost all the school districts in the county to really start looking at the curriculum that's happening within the math, science, and technology fields, if you will. And so I would tell you that, you know, from the conversations I've had with our superintendents and our principals and the teachers, I think there's definitely a very strong focus. I mean, McLean County is blessed with a very, very good school district, or many good school districts. But now it's just a matter of, you know, from the world being a keystroke away, how are we competing with what people are learning and how they're, you know, being challenged in other states and other nations? And so, you know, right now, I don't know that I can specifically answer your question because I'm not in curriculum. I'm only going by what I hear from our employers. And I think our employers are satisfied from the most part on some of the technical types of things, especially when it comes to looking at technology and IT. And there's always room to grow. An example, State Farm, you know, who has worked with Illinois State University for the cybersecurity program. So it's going to continue to evolve and change. There is a lot of work that has been done, a lot of work yet to do. But the real focus that I think employers as a whole are asking for help on is really the essential employability skills, the soft skills. There's been a consistent beat from the surveying that we've done with our businesses across McLean County. Last year, we did a survey which represented about 50,000 of the 80,000 employee base in McLean County. So we feel like we've got a pretty good baseline. And so what we heard from that was it just is there's a big gap in not necessarily the technical skills in STEM or other specifics, but in the coming to work and understanding how to work with a team, understanding self-accountability, understanding respect, understanding little things, even like your own personal grooming. You know, the things that it's interesting, the gamut that really covers essential employability skills. And so what we're working on is, over the last year, I worked with the Illinois Community College Board and some other folks here on campus and around the community to develop kind of what our top seven areas of employability skills look like. And so this afternoon, actually, we're having a presentation to talk about how do we actually write examples, and I won't call it a curriculum, but at least an opportunity for both secondary and post-secondary to take a look at these examples and how they apply in their curriculum that are already being taught. How do we have it at Heartland for them to instruct for, you know, whether they're associate's degree students or transitional employees who are looking for opportunities? How do we have it available for companies that are looking to onboard entry-level employees? And more importantly, when you have an outstanding entry-level employee and you want to promote them, and when you do and they fail, is it were they not ready for that next opportunity, and how are we adequately training those folks? And so it could be train the trainer, where the people, if they have their own internal training department, can train their new employees, or if it's something that Heartland instructs, or if we have private instructors around the community who want to do this. But I will tell you that it seems as though all the conversation we have with employers, that is probably the top concern, is just those employability skills. So we have three main things from an employer standpoint we're looking at right now, which is not only the employability skills we're talking about, but also the Inspire platform, which is an online mentorship, which will start in seventh grade and go through high school. That'll be a big point of discussion. And then student retention. So when you look at Illinois State, we have 70% of campus comes from the Chicagoland market. When we're looking at employee attraction to the community, those folks who are coming to Illinois State already know two of the evils of Illinois better than anyone else, our weather and our politics. So having 70% come from the Chicagoland market, if we can do a better job of intentionally getting them off of the campus and integrating them into the community so that when they transition then from student to employee, that they are set and geared with the right relationships and opportunities to understand what that transition looks like and set for success. So that's really what it is. And stay here. That's exactly right. You know, it's and so part of that being an advantage I talked a little bit about was not only so there's workforce, but just as equally important right now is our quality of life and quality of place component. And so if we're going to have work this hard to retain our current workforce, to attract new workforce, to attract more companies to continue to invest here, we need to make sure that the community in turn supplies what those expectations of those individuals are. So when you have a lot of folks coming from the Chicagoland market, they have different quality of place components when you look at Naperville and Downers Grove and Mount Prospect and some of those different other suburban communities, or than just Chicago Metro itself. You know, so what are we doing to make sure that we're providing a competitive environment that allows them the opportunities that they're looking for, especially if they're still young and transitioning right from college right into being an employee, that the community meets their needs, fulfills their expectations, and allows them the opportunities which would make them think about staying in Bloomington Normal for their career opportunities.
Charlie Moore is president and CEO of the McLean County Chamber of Commerce. Charlie, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I hope we can do this again.
The 21st is supported by the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology, presenting Sandra Singh Low, host of the NPR.org podcast, The Lowdown on Science, for the Smith Group JJR Lecture, noon on Friday, April 20th, in the Beckman Institute Auditorium.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you think of 4-H, what comes to mind? Maybe corn clubs and prize farm animals? Well, that's true, but what about robots and 3D printing? The 4-H of the 21st century is as dedicated to STEM education and robotics as it is to agriculture. And this Saturday is 4-H's big robotics challenge at the Illinois State Fairgrounds in Springfield. To tell us more about that and other ways the program is growing and evolving, I'm joined now in studio by Keith Jacobs, a STEM education specialist with the 4-H department, the State 4-H office. He's also based at U of I Extension. He's in studio with me here in Urbana. I also wanted to welcome Russell Moore, who participated in 4-H in Springfield, is now a student there at Lincoln Land Community College. Keith, Russell, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Russell, can I start with you? I understand you're a student now, as I just mentioned, at Lincoln Land Community College. Before that, you participated in 4-H. How did you first get involved?
Well, I was first involved through a few other groups within the community, which reached out to the 4-H youth instructor, Erica Austin, which connected me further to Keith Jacobs. And then the future of robotics started with there, just going home, messing around with little things like Raspberry Pis and EV3 bricks, just hanging around with those. And then furthermore, went further into a competition, and it kind of went so fast, I didn't realize what was happening at first. So it It was a little adventure. It was a little adventure for that turn from a hobby to an adventure.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Keith, can you explain what raspberry pies are for people who are listening thinking he's talking about food?
Absolutely. Yeah, raspberry pie is definitely not a food. Raspberry pie is a microcontroller. So it's basically it's a little computer that you're able to do a number of different things. So imagine a credit card size computer that you can connect to a screen and do a whole computer thing.
Right. It's essentially a small computer that you can hook up to anything, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so how, Russell, did that lead you to studying computer science? Would you attribute that to 4-H?
Well, originally, I already wanted to study in computer science. 4-H just gave me more of a clear picture and more of a straight road to go to, because before 4-H, I was very zigzag. I didn't really know exactly where to go. And what 4-H did, they helped enhance my skills and focus me in one particular area that they knew I was good at. They would challenge me in other areas that they knew I struggled in, but they made sure they focused on my skill set, which they always make the best better.
That's Russell Moore. We've been talking to him. He's on the line from Springfield. He participated in 4-H in Springfield. He's now a student at Lincoln Land Community College. In studio with me here is also Keith Jacobs. He's a STEM education specialist. And Keith, what that story that you hear from Russell, is that pretty common? I think people, when they think about 4-H, maybe don't realize how much of it is STEM related, robotics and computing.
Exactly.
Is this a story that you hear often?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it is. Coming on, that's what I thought about 4-H. I didn't grow up with 4-H. So when I came on, that's kind of the image that I had until I started getting involved with the youth and doing drone projects and robotics and whatnot. And eventually that flourished to me seeing everything that we did. We have over 200,000 projects in STEM alone in the state that are done by youth every year. So STEM is definitely out there. It's just something that most people just don't openly and first, associate with 4-H.
I want to bring two more people into this conversation. On the line with us as well is the director of Illinois' 4-H program, Lisa Diaz. She's based at the University of Illinois. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks so much.
And we've also got a current 4-H student with us. He's a high school student, Brady Veal. Hey, Brady. Thanks for being here with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Brady, you're at Normal West High School?
Yep.
And I heard that you are a big fan of flying drones as well. Is that true?
Yes, I've actually flown them with Keith before, and I really enjoy it.
And I also understand that you helped organize the robotics competition that's going to be taking place this weekend in Springfield. What did you do on that committee?
Me, along with all the other committee members, we started from the ground up. The challenge this year was the EnviroBot challenge. So what we had to do is we had to design all the challenges and then design the scoring for that and then many other things involving that. But we also made sure that to give the students that are going to be making the robots opportunities to express themselves and show their skills.
So Brady, you're 14, right?
I'm 15.
You're 15. How long have you been working with computers and robotics? How long has that been an interest of yours?
Ever since I joined 4-H when I was around 8 years old. I joined my 4-H club, and the first meeting I went to, there was a robotics demonstration, and I just fell in love with it then. Ever since then, I joined teams, and I was involved with going to competitions and then eventually teaching other students about these robots, and I've eventually gotten to where I am now.
Lisa, as you were listening to these three young men talk about their participation in 4-H, and it's all robotics and computing, do you think that people who maybe are unfamiliar with the program might have some misconceptions about what 4-H is these days?
I do, and I think that's a little bit to be expected for an organization that's been around for over 100 years. We just had some of our own clubs here in Illinois celebrating their 100-year anniversary, and so when you've been around that long, there's a lot of history and a lot of memory, and so I think people who are with 4-H when they were young remember it from that time and may not fully realize that we've continued to grow and evolve and are always looking for ways to continue putting cutting-edge learning experiences in front of the young people that we involve.
And you mentioned 4-H's long history. 4-H also has a long history with the University of Illinois. Can you explain how that relationship works, Lisa?
Sure. We're actually more than just a relationship. We are part of the University of Illinois and always have been. University of Illinois is a land-grant university, receives funding through the U.S. Department of Agriculture as part of that, and have a required component of doing extension or outreach in the community. So research, teaching, and extension have always been very important parts of the University of Illinois, and that extension work happens through our College of Agriculture, Consumer, and Environmental Science, and 4-H has always been the flagship program for doing the youth outreach. So the way that we formed in the very beginning was part of that university extension model.
Brady, how did you first hear about 4-H? You said you started getting used to, you first got involved with 4-H when you were 8, you said.
Yeah, so I grew up with 4-H. My mom was actually involved in 4-H through her work. But so that's how I heard of it. I went to the fair every year, and I always made sure to go and look at all of the different 4-H projects that were being shown there. And from there, I knew I wanted to do that. And there was so many opportunities for me to try different things. I knew that was something that I wanted to do as I got older.
And Russell, how about you? How did you first hear about 4-H?
Same, actually, through the state fair, I saw a lot through the agriculture, and I was introduced. Okay, when I first heard about 4-H, I was 8 years old as well. I actually met with one of the directors for one of the youth groups, because they were very close with my parents. But I didn't join 4-H until I was around 12 years old, because I wasn't entirely sure if I was, you know, capable of the group until they introduced me to it.
Yeah, so it sounds like you had a long history with that. Keith, was that the case for you? Did you also learn about 4-H when you were 8?
So, no, actually, I grew up in California on an island, and there wasn't much ag going on there. So I didn't hear about 4-H until I came to Illinois, and I was in school. And when I left school, I was donating my time to, you know, kids groups and different youth organizations, and 4-H happened to be one of them. Volunteered at the state fair and saw how massive it was, and was just shocked that this whole thing existed. I didn't even know about it, and that kind of just segued into me getting the position I have now.
And Lisa, can I ask you about, to Keith's point about growing up not near agriculture, what is 4-H like in terms of, imagine it's, as we're hearing from some people, their families are very familiar with it. And I think particularly in rural communities, we know that 4-H is pretty popular where agriculture is such an important part of the community. But what are about in more urban areas?
So we have currently, Keith mentioned earlier, we reach about 200,000 youth in Illinois currently, and 27% of our participants live in suburbs or cities over 50,000, and we have dedicated staff in our larger metro urban areas, including Chicago and Rockford, the Quad Cities, Peoria, Springfield, Champaign, Urbana, East St. Louis. And I'm sure I'm missing some, but we've really intentionally placed our resources in a way around the state. We have staff serving all 102 counties in the state, and that importantly includes our cities. So people are surprised, but we're there and doing really incredible programs like the ones that Keith provides leadership for.
And Keith, for the STEM programs you're involved with, how diverse would you say your student population is?
Very diverse. In fact, we have grants that are specifically allocated towards underrepresented groups and low-income areas, especially up north in Chicago. So,
and also Google's gotten involved with you all recently as well.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me about that?
Yes. So this past summer, Google partnered with 4-H to provide $1.5 million towards computer science initiatives. So one thing that we do is we provide programming in virtual reality, computer science, using Scratch and block-based coding, which is basically just coding. Instead of using words and text, you use like blocks. So it's a lot easier. But initiatives like that really help us expand computer science. In fact, Russell, who's on the line, gave the keynote or the youth keynote at our launch that we did this past summer with Google.
Russell, what was it like to be able to work with that?
It was a one-in-a-lifetime experience. I was not only a fond of Google as an organization as well, but the fact that I'm speaking about something that I love, it was a truly eye-opening experience. I never thought I was able to experience something, and going through 4-H just opened so many doors for me.
And not just opening doors, Keith, I wanted to just ask you, we heard Russell talk about the fact that he first heard about this when he was younger. He wasn't really sure about his commitment to STEM and to science. What do you know about young people who are involved in your STEM programs? What kind of outcomes that that leads to for them?
Absolutely, absolutely. Nationally, typically we see that youth, as they progress through high school, are not interested in science or STEM anymore. We see those numbers dropping off. And in our programs, upwards of 95% of youth that are involved in our programs actually continue in science and want to actually go out and participate in science programs. And we see those numbers increase, which is, like I said, contradictory to what most stats show.
And Russell, you're studying computer science. What career plans do you have?
My career plans actually are to follow my STEM careers and either do one of two things, become a computer programmer or actually entrepreneur my own drone manufacturer business, where I program my own coding and manufacture my own designs and drone making.
And are you thinking about agricultural drones or all kind of drones, Russell?
All kind of drones, all kind of drones. Visual camera, agriculture, all type, variety of drones, not just one specific type.
And Brady, what about you? I know you're 15, so you're not quite probably, I don't know if you've decided yet what you're going to be studying after high school, but is it safe to say it would be computer science or robotics or something STEM?
Well, actually, through my high school, there is a pilot program that just started this year. It is a cohort through a community college, Heartland, in Bloomington Normal. And I will be working with the high school in Heartland to graduate with a two-year degree in computer science when I graduate high school. So I will be following computer science and STEM, hopefully throughout college and into my future career.
Yeah, so we were just actually talking about that earlier in the hour. That's great. Brady, can you tell us what you're building for the fair this weekend?
Is he not allowed to talk about it?
It's not necessarily a build. He's on the committee, so he's not participating in the competition.
Oh, I see.
He's going to be one of the judges.
So can you tell us what's the plan for the competition then, Keith?
So overall, in general, we have youth come down to the Orr building, and that's on the state fairgrounds. So we have about 60 teams that come in. They set up their robots. They do the challenges that the design committee came up with. So they run their robots, do a bunch of challenges. Get judged on their performance, get judged on their technical design.
How much time have they spent building these robots?
They've been doing this since December.
Okay.
So it's been some months. So programming, getting all their stuff together and putting their projects together has taken that entire time.
And is this open to the public if people want to come out and see the robotics
competition
on Saturday?
Absolutely. They
could
definitely come out and see the robotics competition on Saturday. It's on the Illinois State Fairground in the Orr Building. And it's free.
Yeah, we'll tweet out details of that. We'll have that at our website, too. Lisa, I just wanted to end by asking you, if people want to get involved with 4-H, either as adults or for their children, what should they do?
They can search online for Illinois 4-H and find the location of their local University of Illinois Extension office. That's the go-to place to get connected in 4-H. And I can give a phone number and a link if you're tweeting that out too, but we're in every county, every community. So 4-H is right next door, wherever you might be living. So it's just a quick phone call away. And again, all those offices can be found really easily by doing a web search for Illinois 4-H.
Right. And we'll get the direct information from you too, Lisa. And we'll have that at our website and that phone number that you mentioned as well. Keith, is this how many robotics competitions have you been to?
So I've been to many, but this, as far as organizing them, this is my second large scale one. This happens to be the biggest one in the state for youth. So,
wow. Yeah. So, and how many students are going to be there this weekend?
So over 400 this year. And last year we had about 500 plus. So the numbers, they shift given you know, whatever the year is. And when we actually have the competition, we're having a little bit closer to in the school now.
All right. So, yeah. So it'll be interesting to see. That's this weekend at the State Fairgrounds in Springfield, 4-H's robotics competition. I want to thank Keith Jacobs for being with me, a STEM extension specialist, Brady Veal, Normal West High School student, Russell Moore at Lincoln Land Community College, and Lisa Diaz, who directs the Illinois 4-H program. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We're in Bloomington Normal this week, learning about its economy, its politics, and more. And for well over a century, people in the area have been spending time at one of Bloomington Normal's highlights, the Miller Park Zoo. In fact, for a long time, it was the only zoo between St. Louis and Chicago. It opened in the late 1800s, now located on historic Route 66. It continues to be popular with travelers. We're here with director Jay Tetlaffs, who's going to show us around. Hey, Jay, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jay, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the history of this. Miller Park opened to, was it right that this was to house exotic animals after a traveling circus left behind a lion cub?
Yeah. So the zoo started in 1891. That's the records. That's as far back as records go. The animal building that we'll see in a little bit, it was built in 1914. It was built for a lion cub that a farmer found. Big Jim was his name. Was the lion
cub
cub's
or
name.
The farmer?
I don't know what the farmer's name. The lion cub's name was Big Jim.
And now, today, what does the collection look like?
So in terms of animal collection, we have about 600 animals, over 175 different species. I don't count our hissing cockroaches or our walking sticks. I don't count our invertebrate collection as part of that.
And you also have a large collection of endangered animals. Can you tell us about Miller Park Zoo's work in that area?
Sure. Some of our more popular animals are endangered. Our red wolves are critically endangered. Snow leopards are endangered. Sumatra tiger are critically endangered. So these are animals that could disappear very easily in our lifetime. Red wolf has been extinct in the wild once, and we're on the path to be extinct in the wild again. That's an animal from North Carolina. That's not from North Africa. That's not from Southeast Asia. That's from the U.S. So if we can't save a high-profile mega mammal apex predator from the U.S., I worry about frogs in Panama.
And what kind of work do you all do with helping? I guess it sounds like, are there breeding programs or what kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, breeding programs are the biggest things that we're doing right now. For example, the snow leopard breeding program, we manage that program on behalf of basically North America. So working with 70 other zoos across North America, we have about 160 snow leopards in North America right now. Moving cats around, breeding with who we feel is in the best interest of the population. The goal for us is to have a sustainable program and population so that my great-grandkids can come to a zoo in North America and see a snow leopard. We've had 5 cubs born over the last 3 years. We suspect our female's pregnant now. So we're looking at cubs in June, hopefully. One is still here. She actually leaves this week. She'll go to a zoo in South Dakota. We've had one go to Kansas, New York. So you figure out the best situation from a genetic standpoint. So for snow leopards, one of our females that's still here, she's going to go to a zoo that doesn't want to breed snow leopards. And she does have a little bit of an eye defect. So we've chosen not to breed her. And so she's going to a zoo that's not going to breed her. They're going to use her as an exhibit animal and tell people that live in that area of what snow leopards are like, which is still a great purpose.
And so do you do genetic testing on the animals before you match them up? How does one go about matching these animals?
Sure. For us, it's mostly about population genetics. So it's not necessarily what genes you have. It's who you're related to in the population. So if you're brought in, so palace cat's a small exotic cat from Mongolia. Not many are in the States. We're actually importing a male for our female. He's in the Czech Republic. He's unrelated to pretty much everything else in the population in the U.S. So he's a very valuable animal once he gets here. He's pretty common over in Europe, but once he gets here, his genetics will be unrepresented until he reproduces. So we do as much of that as we can. It's basically based on population genetics. It's pretty boring stuff for most people.
Well, I imagine for other zoos, though, this is the kind of thing where you're interacting with other zoos. Is it not just around the country, but around the world, it sounds like?
It's around the world in some programs. Red Panda, Sumatran Tiger, Palace Cat, we're working with everybody, our neighbors across both sides of the ocean. Toronto got a zoo for a snow leopard from Japan. So, yeah, we're moving cats and animals all over the world because we're doing what's best for that population.
When you mentioned the history of the zoo, I'm wondering if, in comparison, I'm thinking about Lincoln Park Zoo opened in the 1860s, and I know mm-hmm. that's considered one of the oldest mm-hmm. zoos in the country. Where is Miller Park Zoo in that list of oldest?
So we opened in 1891. We are the 13th oldest. Philadelphia Zoo is number one. I think they're like 1840. No, I'm sorry, like 1740, something like that. So 1891 is pretty old.
Where do your visitors come from? All over the state?
We've started tracking our guests. We're having about 2/3 of our guests come outside of McLean County that are our paid guests. We have a lot of members, and we figure the members are local, so we just ask our paying guests where they're from. The biggest group that we get comes from the Champaign-Urbana area, but we see them from Chicago. We see them. We have regulars that come from Wisconsin. And we're seeing kind of a regional draw for us, which is a great thing.
Should we go outside and maybe you can show us some highlights of
sure.
the zoo?
So this is an unseasonably cold day.
Yes.
What do you give the animals a choice as to whether or not they are inside or out?
So we are set up for winter probably by the end of September. So because with Illinois winters, it could be we get a blizzard in October. It's very possible. So it depends on the animal. If it can tolerate our winter, then everything's fine. If they can't, then we give them access to a building. We bring them inside for the winter. We move them to the other part of the zoo. Lots of different, it all depends on what kind of animal it is. So our Eurasian eagle owls, so a large owl species, it's one of the largest.
Yeah.
They are cold hardy. They have access to their little box.
Yeah, he doesn't say he's not even outside.
So that's the female in the box there.
Okay.
And then the male's right to above her to the left.
Oh, right. Wow.
So Eurasian eagle owl.
Great camouflage.
And they like the cold. And then our river otters. I'll show you a video monitor. So we had pups born. So this is this is a one-year-old daughter. She's going to a zoo in Massachusetts.
Okay, the one who's right over there?
It's one that's in here now. Mom and the two babies are in the back.
Okay.
Not quite ready to come out. So this is the indoor rainforest and the Cotofer Animal Building, the building from 1914.
So this is one of the original buildings?
Yes. We keep it about 70 degrees in the wintertime.
Tropical particularly for the primates?
Everything that's in here is from a Central or South American rainforest. So saki monkeys, cotton-top tamarins, and then all the 20 to 25 to 30 birds that are free flight in this building.
Okay.
So it's a place for our guests to come and kind of feel as though they're walking through the rainforest. All the plants on the waterfall, that's from my dad's funeral.
Oh, wow.
And we'll take cuttings and bring more cuttings in. So I have a personal relationship to this place.
What's your goal with the kids who come here?
The goal is, one, to get them outside. I mean, get them off phones and screens. We want them to understand and learn and get engaged about wildlife. The next generation is the one that's going to depend on if what I did during my time was worth it. Because we want to be a good steward. We want to pass on that stewardship to our grandkids, to our great-grandkids. If people grow up and don't care about wildlife, don't care about natural spaces, green spaces, they're going to disappear. And if they disappear, then all of our animals are going to disappear. And then that's going to affect us. You know, pollinators are in huge decline right now. That's how we eat. So without pollinators, we're going to struggle as a species, if you want to say that, to find food and to be able to do what we want to do as people who live in Illinois. So this is the Cotofer Animal Building. Opened in 1914 and was renovated in the 70s. And it's kind of due for another renovation. It's still the old style
of zoo buildings, zoo exhibits. So, in fact, this winter we're going to be doing some things like taking out all the old mesh, the old caging, and putting up much softer look so that you can see the animal better, the animal can see out a little bit better. We're going to increase the lighting, we're going to increase the skylights in here, and make it a little bit friendlier, more modern building.
And for you all, is it challenging financially to run a zoo like this?
It is for us, as we're part of the city of Bloomington. As a city of Bloomington, we're struggling financially as sales tax has dropped with our retail, much like it is across a lot of different locations. So that does affect us. This year, we had a $3 million deficit through a few fee increases and some cuts, which luckily didn't affect the zoo very much. We're all kind of feeling that heat a little bit and try to make sure we're as efficient and as effective as we can with the dollars we do receive. We try to increase our fundraising as much as we can. So the improvements I just talked about with the new mesh and skylights, that's all private money. It's all fundraised money. There's no tax dollars coming from that. So we hear a lot of people that talk about how great they love that fact that we have a public-private partnership and able to raise some of our own funds. Some buildings like this building, if we were to renovate this entire building, we're talking $6-7 million. That's going to be a tough dollar amount to make in any environment, any economy. Pair of gray gibbons here, the snow leopards, and then tiger. Okay. Yeah, so this is our young lady who's leaving for a zoo in South Dakota this week. I mean, you just heard the tiger.
So how, with the snow leopards, you said you've had 5 cubs born in the past year through the
breeding? In the past three years. Yep, a litter of 2 that we had to hand raise, and then a litter of 3. And we think that she's pregnant now.
How did this zoo, how did Miller Park Zoo become specializing? How did the zoo specialize in snow leopards in particular in the breeding program and working with this critical species?
For snow leopards, it was a program that I brought with me when I came from another zoo. So I've run the program for about 10 years now. I've been here almost 9. So I brought the snow leopard program here, and we really focused on breeding snow leopards since I got here. You know, when it comes to the breeding programs, you know, we all have to work together. It's all cooperative. Zoos have to leave their ego at the door and really focus and work on together. Otherwise, these programs won't work. So that's Rojo, our tiger. Rojo is a Sumatra tiger. It's the smallest subspecies of tiger in the world. They're the darker markings. Just beautiful cats. He just got fed.
So, sorry, is he normally this active?
This is a little bit more than what he normally is. Anytime we do something different, sometimes they catch on to that. Sometimes that bothers them. But he's no worse for wear. You know, activity is not a bad thing for these guys. Tigers sleep 15 to 20 hours a day. Making sure, beautiful cat.
I was gonna
love
say,
those markings.
Beautiful.
Love
and
those markings.
How much does he weigh?
He's a little under 300 pounds. So, again, the smallest subspecies of tiger that's out there. You get Amur tigers or Siberian tigers, they can hit 600, 650 pounds. So these guys get a commercially processed beef, and then we give them cattle knuckle bones twice a week. And that's for their teeth and jaws, since they're not eating a carcass like a deer in the wild. We want to make sure that their teeth and jaws stay strong. A lot of tigers, big cats in general, in the wild, they live to about 10 to 12, and they start seeing teeth problems, and they pass away in the wild. In zoos, we can give things like a root canal and take out that tooth, and they can live another 5 to 10 years. We fast them for at least 12 hours when we're doing some type of immobilization.
And then you put them on a commercial flight?
In this case, they're being picked up by a truck and trailer. But a lot of times we do put them on planes. When we get animals in, a lot of times they're on a plane. It's pretty common. If you're flying a large Delta flight, a large United flight, there's a good chance there's going to be some type of animal in one of the cargo holds.
And if it was something like a snow leopard, would someone be traveling with the animal then?
Usually, but not necessarily. We try to drive the big cats or the big animals from a cost perspective, from a safety perspective for them. Their welfare, but a lot of times we will put something on a plane, and we'll go there. Just like I think Thursday, we're getting some birds in. We'll go to the airport, pick them up like they're luggage.
Well, thanks for showing us around.
You're very welcome.
That was Jay Tetzloff, the director of the Miller Park Zoo in Bloomington, showing me around earlier this week as part of our visit to the Bloomington Normal area. Thanks to him and to WGLT, our partner station, for hosting us. That's all the time for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa and NPR One, you can play us there. You do have to have NPR One enabled, but all you have to do is say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. This week, we've got lots of pictures of us in the Bloomington Normal area, including our visit to the zoo. On our Facebook page, if you search for The 21st to like us, you can also comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Fatima Farha is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.